This is Radio Equal Shock with your host, Alex Smith.
How can we persuade people climate change is a stupendously real tidal wave that we need to quickly seek higher ground? What can we say to the workmate or uncle who denies it, the friend who agrees but does nothing? Seeking answers, intelligent people methodically tested strategies, tools we might call interventions. On May 13th, on the top journal PNAS, their results appear in the paper Behavioral Interventions Motivate Climate Action to Address Climate Change. Let's shop for tested tools we can all use. The lead author is Alyssa H. Sinclair, known to all as Allie. She is a postdoc at the University of Pennsylvania. Allie won her PhD at Duke University in psychology and neuroscience. Her co-authors include Emily Falk and Michael Mann. From Philadelphia, Allie Sinclair, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, some listeners discovered intervention through a dramatic TV series about families trying to rescue addicts. What do you mean by intervention when you're talking about the climate struggle?
Yeah, that's a great question. When I talk about interventions here, I'm using it in a psychological sense. You know, sometimes we might think about clinical interventions, like you just described, for someone who's struggling with addiction, but we can also think about behavioral interventions in a much broader sense, about how we can sort of nudge people to try to change their behavior, for example, in a way that might be better for their health, or in this case, to take action in ways that are better for the environment and to address climate change. So we're talking about simple, non-pharmaceutical interventions that we can do just by talking to people or having them think about something in a way that we think sort of targets processes of how they think and how their brains work to change their behavior.
Wow, pharmaceutical interventions for climate change sounds like an interesting topic for another day. All right, now you begin with three major barriers to sharing climate info and acting on it. Could you take a couple of minutes to lay those out for us? What stops us?
Sure. So in the psychological literature, we can think of a number of factors that might prevent people from taking action to address climate change. And first, I think it's important to acknowledge that a majority of people do believe that climate change is happening. So about 72% of people in the U.S., about 85% of people worldwide, they all acknowledge that climate change is happening and might be pretty worried about it. Of course, the number of people who agree that it's entirely caused by humans might be a little lower, but still, that's a lot of people who acknowledge that we have a problem, and yet many of them are probably not taking action in daily life or talking about it with other people. So what might be sort of creating that gap between belief and action? And there are a few different things that emerge over and over again in the psychological literature. One barrier is distance. So climate change can feel like a problem that's really remote and far away on a number of dimensions. It can be temporally far away, so you think that we won't feel the effects of climate change for a really long time. It's hard to project into the future. Another way that it can be distant is geographically. So you might think that your daily life in your local area might not change very much. Perhaps you think that countries that are far away in the global south will be more impacted by climate change, and so you won't see the effects where you are. And the third type of distance, which is related to that, is self-relevance. So if you think that people like you and you yourself personally won't be really impacted by climate change, then you might feel that it's a very distant problem. In addition to that barrier of distance, there is another barrier that has to do with sort of our perception of relevance, both to us and to people we care about. So we might feel that climate change is not really something that's relevant to you right now. And you can also sometimes underestimate what other people think about climate change and how much support there might be. This is a problem we call pluralistic ignorance, which means underestimating the proportion of other people out there who might hold the same beliefs that you do. So if I assume that I care about climate change, but the people around me don't, I might be hesitant to speak out or take action because I assume that other people wouldn't agree. But that's not true. We know that many people actually do hold these similar beliefs. And so one strategy is potentially to try to increase people's understanding of how many people care about climate change to try to motivate action. The third and final barrier that we addressed in this paper has to do with what we call response efficacy, or our beliefs about whether or not our actions actually matter. So some people might not take action because they believe that individuals don't have the power to do anything, or they might be desiring to take action but not know how to do so effectively. So they feel like they don't have the instructions or know which actions would matter most. So in our tournament, we developed a number of different intervention strategies that tried to target these three main psychological barriers. And we group them under three themes that correspond to those barriers. So we call those themes relevance, where we try to emphasize why climate change is relevant to you and to people you care about. Future thinking, where we try to help people project into the future to understand what climate change could look like and how it could happen to impact them or their local area. And finally, response efficacy theme, where we try to help people understand that their actions do matter and direct them towards the actions that matter most.
When I looked at a quick summary of interlocking aspects of climate information and activism in Figure 2 of your paper, the key to me seemed to be, tell me how climate change is about me. How can we make climate outreach more personal so it sticks?
Yes, you'll notice that many of the interventions that we tested touch on self or social relevance in some way. So helping people relate climate change to themselves and to people they care about, like young people in their lives. And we see that this is quite an effective strategy, not only for getting people to share information about climate change, like news articles and petitions, but also that when you guide people to imagine the future and also emphasize self or social relevance, that's a really effective way to motivate people to change behavior in daily life. So both as a standalone strategy and also by pairing it with other strategies, I think appealing to self and social relevance can be really effective.
And some of the best results came not from shaming people, but imagining the future. As a specialist in neuroscience and psychology, why is future thinking so powerful?
That's a great question and one of my specialties. So our brains are actually very good at something that we call mental time travel. So the same system in the brain, centered around a region called the hippocampus, helps us sort of travel in time to recollect and re-experience the past when we draw on our memories. But it also uses that same process to imagine future or hypothetical scenarios, helping us project into the future and imagine what might be, which can be good or bad when we imagine those situations. But it's really useful either way to guide our behavior. So if we anticipate what the future outcomes of our choices might be, we can make better choices now in order to avoid bad things in the future or to try to strive towards more positive future outcomes. So in the brain, we know that engaging this system can be really beneficial. We call this episodic simulation or episodic future thinking. And when you activate that brain region that's used both for memory and for imagination, you can not only help people make more patient, future-oriented decision-making, but you can also get them to take fewer risks, be a little bit more rational or more patient. You can get them to make better financial decisions, for example, being willing to invest in future outcomes. And you can also use this kind of method to get people to engage in pro-social behavior. So if you get people to imagine future outcomes, like for somebody who's in need, that can get them to want to help that person or donate to a cause. So we've seen a lot of varieties of applications here, and it's all centered around that brain system that is good both for recalling the past and for imagining the future.
And your team discusses imagination exercises as a good tool. Could you give us an example?
Sure. So one of the leading interventions in our tournament when it came to motivating action involved a guided imagination exercise where you visualized what it would be like to experience a negative future due to climate change. And this was a self-relevant future, so you imagined yourself immersed in the scenario. We did this online. It only takes about 5 minutes, so it's pretty accessible. But basically, we have a series of prompts that we give people in writing where we ask them to imagine a scene that takes place in a future city that's been negatively impacted due to climate change. So this is a very hot and polluted city. There are a lot of cars spewing exhaust, people who are angry and honking, a lot of, dying plants and drought and problems like that. We give them some details to start to sort of scaffold this imagination, but then we allow them to fill in the details themselves, and we prompt them to close their eyes and to vividly imagine the scenario using all of their senses. So what they might see, hear, smell, and feel, what it would be like emotionally to be immersed in that scene. And we sort of walk them through it step by step. So they first imagine sort of the broader context of this city, more of like an overhead view of what it would be like. Then they imagine being immersed in the scene, walking down a sidewalk in this city. They imagine the people around them, the cars. You know, what are the people doing? What is it like to spend a day in this life? And then imagining the physical sensations and the emotions that they might feel. So we try to walk them through the scenario in a number of different ways, where we sort of alternate between giving them a short prompt and having them close their eyes and imagine in as much detail as they can. Then they open their eyes and type into a box to describe what they imagine so that we can confirm that they're engaging with the task.
And you also looked into what doesn't work. I mean, for example, who invented the carbon footprint strategy, and does that work?
Yeah, so there was one intervention that we tested that we did not think was very likely to work. Everything else we chose was based on solid theoretical foundations where we thought it had a really good chance of working. But there was one that we didn't think would work, but we felt that we had to test it anyway, and that's the carbon footprints intervention. Now, carbon footprints were actually invented by BP, British Petroleum, who you might imagine has a bit of an interest in distracting from decarbonization and motivating people to take individual action in a way that sort of shifts the blame or attention away from oil and gas companies. And so this tool was popularized by BP many years ago, and since then has really taken off and been used widely. Currently, it's promoted by reputable agencies like the EPA, as well as the World Wildlife Fund. They have their own carbon footprints that they direct people toward. And this seems appealing on the surface to get tailored, personalized feedback about your carbon footprints and ways that you can take action to change it. But there's really hardly any empirical evidence testing whether or not the strategy works, despite the fact that it's so widely used and it's not really based in sound theory. So we felt that it was important to include this intervention in our tournament and see whether or not it works, and particularly whether there are better strategies that would be sort of a better use of our time and energy. And what we found was that the carbon footprint intervention really didn't work for any of our outcomes. It didn't backfire, but it didn't have any positive effect on motivating action or on getting people to want to share information about climate change. It did increase the perceived impact of climate action. So people who learned about their carbon footprint felt that they had, you know, there were ways that they could take action that might be meaningful. And yet there was this gap where despite them feeling like actions might matter, they were not actually more motivated to engage in those actions in the future. So it seems that it's sort of a something that might seem positive on the surface, but is not actually a very effective strategy to try to get people to change their behavior in the longer term.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Dr. Ali Sinclair from Penn, and our topic is what really works to communicate the climate challenge. There was a huge international study published in 2024 led by Madalena Vascanu at Stanford. It involved almost 60,000 participants from 63 countries, and it used a tournament approach. Does your new study build on this, or how is yours different?
Yeah, we are big fans of that mega study that was conducted by Madalena Vascanu and colleagues. One strength of that prior study is that they also, like we did, used an intervention tournament approach, which means that you get to test many different theoretical predictions, many different ideas, all at the same time in a big sample, and then you can really compare them head-to-head because you've got the exact same outcome measures as a kind of common currency. And a benefit of this approach, which we also use, is that it shifts the question from being, does it work or not, to what's the most effective strategy and why. So it really is a great way to test a lot of ideas and find the most optimal communication strategies. But there were a couple of things that were different from their tournament to ours, and I think ours really builds on theirs in a meaningful way and introduces some new ideas and new findings. So first off, almost all of the interventions that we tested were different from what they did in their tournament. Second, they took a different approach where they crowdsourced intervention ideas, which led to some really interesting things that they tested, but also was a little less systematic. So we took a more theory-driven approach where we started with some existing theories about different ways of changing behavior and different barriers that are present that might prevent people from acting to try to address climate change. And we sort of systematically brainstormed interventions that would target those barriers. So we took a bit of a different approach in terms of deciding on what interventions to include. We also had different sampling approaches. So In the prior tournament, this was a global study, so they recruited people from many different countries. This was a huge team effort, and one pro of that is that they are able to investigate cross-cultural differences, which is really useful for people who might want to think about how they could tailor interventions to different cultural contexts or different communities or groups of people. In contrast, in our study, we focused on the U.S., which means that we don't have as much generalizability to a global context, but does mean that we can do a deeper dive on things like, for example, political polarization within the U.S. and how it relates to climate change. Another important thing to note is in terms of our outcome measures, we had a different set of outcome measures, and there was also some findings from the prior study that revealed some really important gaps and challenges for future research, which we helped to address. So in that prior work, they found that none of their interventions effectively motivated climate action, and in fact, several of them backfired. So, for example, one of the leading strategies that they found for motivating people to share information about climate change was negative emotion induction, or, you know, scaring people, essentially. And even though that worked for getting people to want to share information, it actually backfired when it came to climate action. So that reveals the importance of testing new, different strategies that might motivate action without potentially being demoralizing, leading to catastrophizing, and things like that. And so in our study, we tested alternative strategies with a sort of complementary set of outcome measures, and we found some strategies that did effectively increase intentions to take action without backfiring on other outcomes like information sharing.
Ali, I want to dip back into a 2021 neuroscience paper you published in PNAS. After stipulating predictions of the future are built on memories of the past, you investigate the role of surprise or error. Now, it seems to me crazy weather these days has lots of surprises. We all expected this to happen much later, and we've never seen such damaging events before. Ask the people in Asheville, Carolina. So when we realize the reality of climate, or we get shocked by an emergency, do our brains need to go back and rearrange our memories?
That's a great question, and that relates back to the ideas that I shared previously about how our brains kind of time travel in order to guide our decisions and our behavior in a way that makes sense to help us kind of keep pace with the changing world. So that same memory system centered on the hippocampus that allows us to recall the past and imagine the future also helps us learn from our mistakes. So when we predict that something will happen based on our past experiences, and it's surprising, it doesn't turn out the way that we expected, that brain region sort of responds to that surprise, and it creates an opportunity for us to revise our knowledge and change our behavior accordingly. So that can help us adapt when we find that things are not the way that they were before and things are changing. So surprise is a really useful catalyst that can help us learn and update our beliefs and can also motivate us to change our behavior.
And your 2021 study also found memories created by curiosity stay with us longer and more clearly compared to memories formed during high stress events. So creating urgency might actually decrease memory about climate science compared to luring people in with curiosity?
Yes, I think you might be talking about the 2023 PNAS paper there. So I know there are a few. It's a little confusing. But yes, in another study, we looked at how different motivational states, for example, emphasizing urgency or trying to evoke a more curious and future-oriented sort of exploratory mindset, how those different motivational states would change the way people learn and make decisions, and then the details of what they remember in the future. We've actually applied some of those theoretical insights from that paper to news headlines about climate change really recently. We have a preprint up that's currently on SciArchive, which is a preprint platform, where we took a bunch of news headlines about climate change, and we created alternate versions of those headlines where we tried to evoke these different motivational states. So sometimes we really tried to emphasize crisis and urgency, sort of upping the ante about a story, whereas in other cases we took the same underlying news story and we wrote an alternate headline that tried to evoke a bit more of a future-oriented, action-oriented, or curious mindset. So focusing on solutions or what people are doing to address a problem. And what we found was that both of those strategies can increase engagement, so increasing people's willingness to read and share that information. But there's also a really interesting trade-off, where in the moment, if you emphasize crisis, that can be more effective for getting people to read and share information and also to make real charitable donations to related causes. But the next day, if you bring them back, they actually have worse memory for the details of that news content that they read. In contrast, when you try to evoke a more future-oriented or curious mindset, we find that it's, you know, still pretty good at increasing engagement in the moment, and the next day they actually have enhanced memory for the content of that information. And so we think this is really useful, especially in the context of climate change, to think about these pros and cons to different emotional or motivational framing strategies, because sometimes we do want people to sort of wake up and take action in the moment, but we also know that when it comes to long-term problems like climate change, it's not enough to just act in the moment and then be done with it. You know, this is a chronic problem that requires sustained action, retaining information, and sort of striving towards future goals. And so inducing a more positive and future-oriented motivational state might be more useful in cases like that.
So millions of people spend more time in cyberspace than they do on the ground. Is it enough to be an information warrior reaching people's cyber persona, or do we need physical meetings and rallies and gatherings? Ali, do we need a new strategy to reach both the person and their net persona?
Mm-hmm. I think these are complementary approaches to do online interventions as well as in-person rallies and other activities. So one benefit of taking an online approach is that information spreads so rapidly and so widely. So we can tap into these social networks, for example, by getting people to read and share information about climate change, and that can sort of propagate to reach many different people and change social norms. So if I start seeing that many people in my social network are talking about climate change and sharing news headlines about climate change or expressing their opinion, that might make me feel less alone, and perhaps I then have the courage to do the same. And so this is kind of a self-perpetuating effect that can really potentially have a lot of benefit. But at the same time, we also know that in-person gatherings can be really motivating. It can make people feel that they're a part of a sort of a social movement that might be really compelling and encouraging. And so having this kind of in-person activity, which can, you know, get attention for policymakers and also gain momentum to help people build community and build resilience to support tackling this long-term challenge, I think that's very important as well.
One of the design purposes of your program at Penn, where Professor Michael Mann has a leadership role as well, is to draw the whole university into helping to solve the climate crisis. We need more than just meteorologists and climate scientists. We need economists and historians and psychologists and many more. But neuroscientists too?
Well, I certainly hope so. I think neuroscientists have a different perspective to offer. By thinking about the way our brains work, we can sometimes generate new and surprising predictions about what psychological strategies might be most effective. Like, for example, with the work that I mentioned before about the crisis and urgency framing leading to memory impairment for the details that they read, that's a prediction that wouldn't necessarily come from the communication literature, but does make sense when you think about neuroscience and how negative emotion or sort of an urgent motivational state engages a particular brain system that leads to these trade-offs that we see in behavior. So that's one example of how bringing a neuroscience perspective can be really enlightening, I think. But yes, as you mentioned, I'm part of the Penn Center for Science, Sustainability, and the Media, which is led by Michael Mann. And one key goal of the center is to bring together interdisciplinary groups to bring all of those unique perspectives from across different literatures, across different training backgrounds, in order to tackle this multifaceted problem of climate change and improve communication.
So wrapping it up, if I'm part of an environmental group or just a personal activist, can you give us a couple of strategies to reach more people and get them contacting politicians or building low-carbon towns?
I think the number one take-home idea from our tournament would be that if you can phrase your news or calls to action in a way that guides people to imagine the future, especially when you make it relevant to themselves and people they personally care about, then that's going to be an effective way to motivate people to want to engage, to take action, and also to try to get them to spread the word and share that information with other people, which is useful for these sort of broader network effects.
Ali Sinclair, what are you working on next?
We're currently working on a number of studies that sort of extend on the findings from our intervention tournament. So one limitation of what we did so far is that we focus on intentions. So we look at a variety of actions, like individual actions, including eating less meat, driving less, or flying less, as well as collective actions, like contacting your representatives or participating in protests and things like that. But we are just looking at sort of future intentions to engage in those things. The end goal is to directly measure actual behavior in the real world and over time to follow up with people. So in ongoing studies, we're doing that right now. And we're also exploring how we can try to bridge the partisan divide when it comes to climate change in the U.S. And we're looking at our existing data as well as new data that we're collecting to try to see which strategies are most effective for reaching conservatives, which is not always the same strategy as sort of the overall number one leaders in our tournament.
From the University of Pennsylvania, we've been speaking with postdoctoral researcher Alyssa H. Sinclair. She leads a May 2025 study in PNAS called Behavioral Interventions Motivate Action to Address Climate Change. It is a goldmine for what works in climate activism, I think. You can find free links to this open source paper in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Ali, thank you for sharing time with our listeners.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org.